Phil. I know you'll expect me to have some cheap humor about rain and Noah, but that's too obvious. I don't even need to say anything. I was more impressed that rain is a symbol, really. Jesus said, God causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous. And, you know, think about how generous God is, how he lavishes good gifts on us. Boy, somebody's getting some messages. And when I hear that little Verizon doo-doo-doo, reminds me of when I had a server meltdown a couple of years ago and was getting those every few seconds all night. So please turn that off. Houston, we have a problem. With those words, Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert, and Fred Heise communicated danger when they were 200,000 miles away from Earth. The Apollo 13 mission was launched April 11th, 1970 at 1:13 p.m. Central Standard Time. And 2 days later, an oxygen tank ruptured. That crippled the service module upon which the command module depended. To conserve batteries and oxygen needed for those last hours of flight, the crew crawled into the lunar module as a kind of lifeboat during the return trip to Earth. Despite the great hardship they experienced, caused by limited power and loss of cabin heat, shortage of potable water, and the critical need to jury-rig the carbon dioxide removal system with duct tape and slide rules, the crew did return safely to Earth on April 17. When you are surrounded by darkness and danger, it's nice to have an ark. Heaven, we have a problem. No one is recorded as saying those words. But I wonder whether Noah thought something similar. Because he, alone in his generation, saw the rampant and reckless wickedness that characterized his generation and the population of Earth. Now, all of us know the story of Noah and the Ark. It's an especially popular teaching for children. You know, God takes care of Noah and his family and the animals. And thus, the imagery of that event, because it is often aimed at children, is uniformly benign. You know, there's Noah with his long white beard. He's surrounded by happy animals, appearing to be having fun. There's a stylish boat. There's a dove on the wing with an olive branch in its beak. And in the background, there is a beautiful rainbow. And yes, that is the cast of characters in this story. But that is a seriously sanitized version of what really happened. Now, I'm not suggesting that we make things too scary for our children. But what was happening in and around the ark was more Harry Potter than Beatrix Potter. You're scratching things. See, Peter Rabbit. Oh, yeah, Peter Rabbit. At that point in time, millions, if Henry Morris is correct, billions of people drowned animals drowned as a cataclysm from above, convulsions from below put an end to non-aquatic animal life on this planet. Except for 8 persons, the entire human race perished. Even that rainbow. The rainbow was not a sign that regeneration would be renewed. The rainbow was a promise that extermination would not be repeated. The story of Noah and the ark is rich. It's rich in symbolism and significance. It's rich in drama and dogma. It speaks of relationship, righteousness, and rescue. It's an event from the past, but it is also a warning for the present, and it is a preview for the future. But that's all for future studies. This morning, what I'd like for us to do is to briefly get inside the box and then do a little bit of thinking outside the box. Phil read it, but let's review. Genesis 6:13. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its breadth, 50 cubits, and its height, 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with a lower second and third decks." You know, there on your gas tank and probably again at the pump, the station, you get a warning about overfilling. You know, if you overfill, dangerous things will happen. Well, villainy and violence had reached that critical limit. It was full. And bad things were about to happen. Destruction had been decreed. But before the wipeout, God initiated a way out. God tells Noah to make an ark. Not a boat, not a barge, not a cutter, cruiser, or carrier. He told him to make an ark. And somehow, our image of an ark has been a little glamorized. The Hebrew word teva means box or chest, sometimes even coffin. Now Moses, who wrote these words, knew something about arks because he had an experience with an ark very early in his life. When he was just an infant, his mother placed him in a teva, an ark, among the reeds of the River Nile. And this ark that God had Noah build was missing a few familiar nautical elements. It had no mast. It had no sails. It had no keel. It had no rudder. It was a box. It wasn't going anywhere. It was probably not a very comfortable ride. But it was perfectly designed to do what it was intended to do, to float in a flood and rescue a remnant. It was a box. And it was big. Did you catch those dimensions? Now, a cubit. A cubit is the length of your elbow to your middle finger. That's a cubit. I measured mine this week. It's 19 and a half inches. Your mileage may vary. But for the sake of round numbers, let's call a cubit 18 inches. That is a foot and a half. So that means that this ark God commanded Noah to build was 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. That translates to a little over 1.5 million cubic feet. Or in nautical terms, where 100 cubic feet equals one ton, about 15,000 tons. The ark was the size of about 520 railroad cars. If you took 18 good-sized two-story tract homes and you placed them two abreast and nine long, and then you put an identical layer of another 18 on top of those for a total of 36 homes, you'd have just about an ark-sized collection of houses. The footprint of the ark was about half the width of a football field and a football field and a half long. You could fit over 20 basketball courts on its deck. In other words, it was big. The ark was a box. That box was big. And it was probably also black. There in verse 14, God tells Noah to cover it inside and out with pitch. Now that pitch was either a bituminous coal product, kind of like the slurry they use for making asphalt roads, or a resin from conifer trees that was used as caulking between the logs. But either way, the pitch was probably heated for application, and with heat and age, it turned dark. So the ark was dark in more than one way. The window that is mentioned in verse 16, don't think of a big plate glass window. Think of a little ventilation port around the top, big enough for a dove to get in and out. But this is more for ventilation than for light. And it's up there at the top of a four-story, three-deck structure. So the ark was dark on the outside, and it was dark on the inside as well. The ark had dorms and decks and a door. It was designed for living, but not luxuriously. Mostly, it was designed for surviving. So Noah and his family and a zoo full of animals and birds and other critters and the food to feed them would escape the flood in this big black box. We'll save the discussion of the animals for our study of chapter 7. But just kind of as an aside, notice there in verse 20 and 21 that Noah is responsible for the animals to keep them alive. So this was a cruise, but it was not a pleasure cruise. It was a working cruise. It wasn't a pleasure cruise, and it probably wasn't a pleasant cruise either. I would guess for those about 6.5 months aboard the ark, that was not an entirely enjoyable time for Noah and his family. But it certainly beat the alternative. So, that's our tour of the ark. It's a big old black box. Now, I'd like for us to do some thinking outside the box. Not sinking outside the box. That happens in chapter 7. Thinking outside the box. That pun is courtesy of Lisa. As I was reflecting on this passage over the last few weeks, several things struck me, but three really stood out. Three things that as I just sort of pondered them and meditated, I realized these were challenging me. These are things that don't fit neatly in tidy little box-like categories. They force me to think outside the box. And the first of these challenges appears in verses 5 to 7. In our study of Genesis thus far, we have encountered a series of recorded words spoken by God. And those divine statements take a startlingly downward trajectory. Not at first. In chapter 1, during 6 days of artistic, creative frenzy, God speaks the universe into existence. And when he's finished, he declares, "It is very good." But his next pronouncement is, "It is not good. It's not good that the man be alone." And as so often seems the case, the solution to that problem just changed the problem. That first couple, Adam and Eve, they were placed in a perfect environment. They were innocent. They were naive. They were absolutely unburdened with sin or shame or guilt or regret. And that's what made their rebellion all the more horrible. Very good. Not good. In chapter 3, God asks, "Where are you?" And he's asking it to a man who is cowering in the shrubbery, trying to hide, because he had suddenly and shamefully become aware of his wretchedness as a consequence of his willfulness. In chapter 4, God speaks again. "Where is your brother Abel?" And God asks, not because he is clueless, but because Cain the murderer is remorseless. In chapter 5, God is silent. As the descendants of Adam through Seth are hatched, matched, and dispatched in a downward spiral that takes them further and further from God. And here in Genesis 6, God speaks again. And this time we encounter some of the saddest words in all the Bible. Look at verse 5. "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, 'I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals, to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry I have made them.'" Last week, Randy led us in a study of the first half of chapter 6, and he bravely tackled the confusing issue and the conflicted identities of the sons of God and daughters of men. And I agree with Randy's assessment that despite all the theological challenges, that the language just suggests that we've got angels and humans intermarried, and probably these Nephilim or the hybridized offspring. But that's an interpretive challenge. But that's not the only challenge in this chapter. There may be another challenge in the first 8 verses of Genesis 6 that are even bigger than the Nephilim. It's what I call sovereign regret. Now let's recount and catalog a few things we know about God. Things that He has revealed to us in His book. We know that God is omniscient. Now, there's a whole bunch of big words used to describe God because He's big. He's omniscient. That is, He knows everything. He knows the beginning, the end, and all the in-betweens. He is omnipotent. Nothing is too hard for Him. Nothing is too high for Him. Nothing is too heavy for Him. Nothing is too hairy for Him. He can do everything. We also know from His word that He is perfect. That is, He does not sin. He does not lie. He is not tempted. He is absolutely pure and perfect in all His ways. We know that He is sovereign. In other words, He is the absolute ruler of the universe. He rules over everything. He chooses. He determines. His will is absolute and inviolable and irresistible. We know from His word that He is also immutable. He never changes. He is always consistent. He is the one constant in a sea of variables. So, how can a sovereign God be sorry? How can an immutable God experience regret? How can an omniscient God wish He had not done something? Now, there are a few possible strategies towards resolving this problem of sovereign regret. One is to reduce the extent of God. You know, maybe He's not as big as we thought. Maybe He is limited. Maybe, like the Wizard of Oz, there's a con going on, and we keep being told, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. And my friend, there's much to like about this option. If God is small, and a little God is a big if God is small, He cannot command you. He cannot control you. He cannot condemn you. He cannot catch you. And let's face it, even though we don't really believe that, sometimes we live as if we do. You know, we sometimes conduct ourselves as if God is not great, or at least He is not greatly involved in the course of our lives. We act sometimes as if God did not know or see or care what we do. We make plans as if His will won't. We worry. We worry as if His power and protection were for an earlier, simpler age, not for ours. We scheme and we dream to fulfill what we want rather than finding and doing what He wants. If you say God is small or absent or irrelevant, you may have solved a few critical problems. But you've created a whole bunch more. You know, for one, you've joined the school of fools. For the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And when you graduate from the School of Fools, you get a diploma. And that diploma is a one-way ticket to ruin. Not only have you joined the School of Fools, but if you say God is small or absent or irrelevant, you've put yourself at risk. Because what if you're wrong? What if God exists outside the periphery of all that you see and know? What if you have confused confidence with ignorance? You know, I would guess there are many folks in Noah's generation that did not believe in rain until the storm came. And then it was too late. So one way to resolve this challenge of sovereign regret is to reduce the extent of God. But a better way is to at least attempt to deduce the intent of God. We see what God said, but we may also need to try to wonder why he said it. In Genesis 1, there on that page, we see a mind-numbing array of mathematical equations. We see technical explanations of sequence and process that defy our puny intellects. Some of you aren't even smiling at me like you're believing what I'm saying. No, we don't. There are no equations in Genesis 1. There's no technological explanations. The complexity of creativity is reduced to three words. Then God said. In other words, there's a whole lot of dumbing down that occurs in Genesis 1. It's not intended as an insult. It's just a concession to the fact that we would never understand. Now, maybe someday in glory, God will give a seminar in how he did it. And I'll tell you what, I will be in the front row. But in the meantime, we just settle for the simple. And that's about what we can handle. His ways are infinitely higher than our ways. His thoughts infinitely higher than our thoughts. We could never grasp his mind or his methods. So he dumbs it down. He makes a concession to our limits and lacks. In Genesis 3, we see another kind of concession. Hold that thought. In Genesis 3, the infinite and the invisible God walks and talks in the garden with Adam in the cool of the day. Now, the Apostle Paul tells Timothy and you and me that God is immortal and invisible. The Apostle John tells us in John 1, no one has seen God at any time. Invisible, no one's seen God at any time. Those two statements are absolutely true. But while God is beyond our senses, he can reveal himself to our senses. He is invisible, but he can appear. He conceals himself, but from time to time, he reveals himself. No one has seen God at any time, but they saw something. And that something looked remarkably human. Now, our Mormon friends are confused. The appearance of God like a man does not mean that he is a man. No one has seen God at any time, but we have seen something. And we use a word to describe this. Are you ready for a big word? Anthropomorphism. That's probably worth at least 100 in Boggle. Anthropomorphism. It describes this situation where God takes a human appearance. We see it in the Garden of Eden. And we will see it again a few more times in the book of Genesis as we continue our study. I think that sovereign regret that we encounter in Genesis 6 is another kind of concession for us. Anthropomorphism allows us to see God, who is beyond vision. Anthropopathism, there's your second big word. Anthropopathism allows us to understand God, who is beyond comprehension. In a concession to our limits and lacks, he speaks in a way that we understand. He refers to feelings and emotions that communicate to us because they resonate within us. We know what it means to be sorry, to be grieved, to regret. God speaks of his emotions in very human terms. And that's anthropopathism. And the Bible has lots of examples. Let me just share one for you that's one of my favorites. In Hosea chapter 11, don't bother turning there, it's hidden. Not really, but it just feels that way. God asks a series of questions concerning judgment, which is impending. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I surrender you, O Israel? How can I make you like Adma? How can I treat you like Zeboiim, a couple of collateral damage communities in Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction? My heart is turned over within me. This is God speaking. My heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. Now, God is not a man. But he knows how to communicate to a man like a man. And I think that's what we encounter here in Genesis 6. And these words in Genesis 6, verse 6, they are just about the saddest words in all the Bible. The Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. These are the saddest words until we read even sadder words in the New Testament. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? On a Friday, during darkness at midday, Jesus Christ hung in agony on a cross. And he lamented an alienation that hurt worse than his wrists, ankles, scalp, and back. For at that moment in time, for all time, he was bearing the sin of the world. He was becoming the sin of the world. And the sovereign God, undoubtedly with infinite regret, was pouring out wrath on the Son whom he loved, so that he might be able to then shower mercy on evil and ungrateful mankind. Mercy. It's something we see at the cross. It's also something I think we get a glimpse of at the ark as we think outside the box. God is merciful, but it is a severe mercy. I don't know if C.S. Lewis coined that phrase, but I learned it from him. Severe mercy. Now justice, we know what justice is. Justice is getting what you deserve. Mercy, conversely, is not getting what you deserve. If there's no justice, then there is no mercy. There's just kindness. You know, if your children are fighting and you intervene and you tell them to be quiet and get along, although you would have said it much nicer than that, if you do that, you have reduced the conflict and hopefully the noise, but you have not induced mercy. Now, if they broke something, then justice is likely to appear and mercy can come into play. Genesis 6 reveals a father with children in absolute revolt. Every intent of the thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually. They were breaking things. But God is merciful. We know that God is just because Adam and Eve were evicted from Eden for their sin, clothed in the skins of an innocent animal killed to cover them. Yet we know that God is merciful because there were not two little piles of ash where Adam and Eve took the first bite. We know God is just because Cain was disfigured, dispossessed, and dispersed. But we know that God is merciful because Cain got to live. We know that God is just because of what we read here in Genesis 6, verse 7. I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land. Yet we know that God is merciful because a handful of folks survived that judgment. God is merciful. But His is a severe mercy. It's not a pat on the head, oh, never mind, kind of mercy. It is a heroic intervention from violent consequences kind of mercy. And I think what we see with Noah and the ark is the general principle that judgment is wide. Mercy is narrow. To experience judgment, all you have to do is be alive. To experience mercy, you need a lifeboat. To be judged, you don't have to do a thing. To be rescued, you need to get on board. Judgment is wide. Mercy is narrow. Jesus said something about that. We saw it in our study of Matthew half a lifetime ago. In Matthew 7, verse 13, these are the Master's words. Enter through the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small, and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Judgment is wide, mercy is narrow. The ark was the vehicle of mercy for Noah and his family. The cross is the vehicle of mercy for you and me. Both of these remedies are singular remedies to universal judgment. Both of these remedies are God's idea. Both are made of wood. One is covered in pitch, the other covered in blood. In both cases, you do not experience the benefit until you get on board. But there's a big difference between the ark and the cross. The capacity of the ark was 8. The capacity of the cross, unlimited. When you believe in Jesus Christ, when you put your trust in Him to rescue you, to forgive you, then His punishment is applied for you. And His perfection is applied to you, and you are placed in Him. Safe. Forever. Bound for heaven. Jesus said, "The one who comes to me, I will in no way cast out." That's mercy. But it is a severe mercy because it is narrow. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." We read in 1 Timothy 2, "There is one God, and there is one mediator between man and God, the man Christ Jesus." In Acts 4, Peter tells an assembled multitude, "There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which we must be saved." Judgment, it's wide. Mercy is narrow. Anyone can find the broad road that leads to destruction. Only the few, the wise, the desperate, find the narrow road that leads to eternal life. Jesus said, "I am the way." Follow Him. Well, I told you there are three things out of the box that challenged me. Those are two. Sovereign regret that God says something that mystifies us, but I suspect He communicates to us, like us, so that we will understand His heart. Severe mercy, we see in Noah's experience that God is just, yet He provides the way to escape judgment. Another thing that challenges me in this passage is what I call sweaty faith. You know, I don't know about you, but I like happy endings in stories and movies. I think most of us like happy endings. But, you know, we're kind of in a hurry. You know, we prefer to have things wrapped up quickly. Noah's is a happy ending. But it is definitely not a hurried happy ending. The last verse of chapter 5 tells us that Noah was 500 years old when his three sons were born. And Genesis 7, verse 6, tells us that he was 600 years old when he and his family and his menagerie exited the ark, actually entered the ark. In other words, Noah spent the better part of a century building the box. That's a long time. That's longer than I've been alive, almost. No, it's long. And Noah had no CAD program. He had no paper or pencil or calculator. He had no measuring tape. He had no power tools. He had no lifts or cranes. I doubt he had many tools at all, and I suspect that he had very little help. And yet, isn't it interesting that Moses gives us only one sentence? One sentence to describe a century-long process of building the box. Verse 22, Thus Noah did. According to all that God had commanded him, so he did. Nike says, just do it. Noah says, I did it. Man. And that must have been his lifelong pattern, because again in chapter 7, verse 5, we read, Noah did according to all the Lord had commanded him. Now, the writer of Hebrews has an interesting insight on this event. I'll read it for you. Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, by faith, Noah, in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So, wait a minute. Did Noah build the ark by faith, or did Noah build the ark by sweat? The answer is yes to both. He believed God, and he pounded nails. He trusted and he obeyed. He lived his faith. He worked his faith. He discovered that God was reliable, and so he was reliable. But you'll notice that Noah was not working just for the sake of work. This was not an attempt to try to score points with God. He did what the Lord commanded. He found out what God wanted him to do, and he did it. And then he kept on doing it and doing it consistently, faithfully, reverently for a long, long time. Now, sweat does not get you to heaven. Jesus does. But arks do not build themselves. And if you're wondering, yes, you can be a slacker and still go to heaven. But it is unconvincing and probably dangerous to call Jesus Lord and not do what he says. So, let's summarize. The ark, it's a big black box. And outside the boxes, we have seen a drama was unfolding. We see a God who transcends us, but who also condescends to us so that we will know his heart. We see a God who is just and who is willing to judge, but who is also merciful and extremely slow to judge. And he has provided an ark for Noah, and fortunately for you and me. Our ark is named Jesus. For as the angel announced, he shall save his people from their sins. And our response to this big-hearted, merciful God should be the kind of faith that leads us to love him and follow him and serve him, even when it gets sweaty. Let's pray. We thank you, Father, that you and your word give us heroes. And you have condensed so much about this man, Noah, into just a few words. We don't expect any of us really to have our lives written up, certainly not in your word or even in other people's words, but may our lives ring true as did Noah's. As we know you, as we follow you, as we reflect you, as we declare you, may you look good for Jesus' sake. Amen.